return this loaner car because its exhaust system had to be replaced. The service department then loaned me another 1986 car. Under ORS 646.315-646.375, my car should have qualified as a legal lemon. The current law states that a total of 30 business days or 4 attempts to repair the car on any defect will qualify for replacement of the vehicle. My car was in the shop for 36 business days the first time and a total of 54 business days. The day I traded the car off, it still had a choke problem, which had never been corrected. Subaru America does not participate with AutoCAP or the Better Business Bureau Arbitration Board, and they do not have their own formal arbitration process. Since I did not have an objective third party to review my case, I've had to work as a partner with my dealership. I have contacted over 17 individual resources for advice on resolving a legal lemon. See attached resource list. On May 6, 1986, at 4,216 miles, while driving down Interstate 5 to work, I saw the temperature indicator was running into the red zone. I had Don Cohen of Bob Brown Subaru inspect the car's air cooling system, and comparing the car with another 1986 Subaru, he advised me that a slightly red temperature indicated was normal for this model car. On May 12, 1986, at 4,827 miles, when I took the car in for its 1,000-mile checkup for the new engine after the block replacement, I spent $19 for fluids which had to be replaced. Because the car was still starting cold and lugging at 50 to 55 miles, Cole and I discussed again the temperature indicator being in the red zone. The service team made adjustments to correct the starting and lugging problems, but continued to think that temperature was normal. I suspected there was a problem with the car's temperature. On May 19, 1986, at 5,439 miles, while I drove home on Interstate 5, the car overheated. The temperature gauge rose to the top of the heat zone and beyond. I called Bob Brown Subaru and was advised that I should drive the car to Portland rather than travel on to Salem where I lived. On the way to Brown Subaru, I stopped at Exxon station for gas and the attendant opened the hood. The water cap was too hot to touch. When it was removed, the water was steaming and the water level was extremely low. So we filled the radiator so that I could continue to drive the car to Brown Subaru. The temperature returned to normal, the needle resting at the beginning of the white zone. At Brown Subaru, the car was test driven and the team did not think it had a temperature problem, but decided to keep the car for observation.
Think about that.
Subsequently, the service team replaced the thermostat. I was without the car from Friday afternoon until Monday during the repair. A footnote, yes, I did have a loaner. On May 28th, at 6,325 miles, while I drove down Interstate 5, the oil pressure gauge went to zero. So I took the car immediately to the nearest Subaru dealer. And there we had a three-way conversation with Bob Brown Subaru Service Department. The result was that Eastgate Subaru kept the car and replaced the oil sending unit. Because Eastgate Motors does not have loaner cars, I had to rent one, the cost of which was covered under my additional service package purchase, which I had bought the car. The repair took over 2 days. Note, because after the second day, the service department had not received the part, it took a sensor unit off another 86 car, so I could have my car back. However, the salesman could not remember which car's sensor had been used for the repair part. On June 6, 1986, I met with Jim Brown and Doug Runkle of Bob Brown Subaru. We all agreed that I needed a safe and reliable car and that I should get the car replaced. The next step I was told was to contact Brett Gunderson, district representative from Subaru Northwest, to see what could be done to put me into a new car. On June 18, 1986, I met with Brent Gunderson, District 1 representative from Subaru Northwest, John Baker, service manager at Bob or Brown Subaru, and Jim Brown, who joined us at the end of the meeting. While Brown was cooperative and willing to send a support letter with my 3 pages of documentation to Subaru America, Gunderson advised Brown not to do so because the dealership could be sued. Gunderson did approve the hood damage repair, but because he failed to inspect the car, I had to make an additional trip to the dealership. He also said that if I brought clothing damages during the time I was broken down and receipts for them, I would receive a check for the purchase price of the clothing. I did follow through, but when he saw the replacement cost of the professional clothing, approximately $292, he paid only $75 in damage and request the return of the dress. Gunderson was rather aggressive, and his attitude was enthusiastic. At the end of this meeting, he indicated I had never had any major damage to my car, and Subaru Northwest had never replaced a car and did not plan to replace this car. But no, I'd like to share a personal story that happened I think you'd find real amusing. At the end of the closure of my meeting with Brent Gunderson, he turned to me and says, "Well, you need to have faith in your car." And he was just going through the motions, and I responded to Mr. Gunderson. I said, "I need to have faith in this car. Brent, I just don't understand." I said, 2 days prior to the engine blowing up the first time on I-5, I took the car to the priest, and the priest blessed the car. We put a new engine back into this car, and I took the car back to the priest, and he re-blessed the car, and he threw holy water on the car, and I don't know what you expect me to do next with this car. Following this conversation, I sent 3 pages of documentation to Mr. Gibson, president, and to Beth St. Clair, customer relations to Subaru America. See attached response. Beyond what I've had is a chronic. I've experienced additional safety-related problems with my car. On August 23, 1986, while driving at 30 miles down a public street, the car stopped, again requiring a trip to the dealership for examination and repair. Following this repair, Subaru Northwest told me that I need to learn how to drive my car. On November 7th of 1986, I went to the gas station and discovered I had a stripped gas cap. John Baker of Bob Brown's Subaru Service Department had to break the cap to replace it with a new cap. On 1 December 29th of 1986, I was driving to work on Interstate 5, and approximately 7 a.m., I hit a water blanket and lost all the power in the car, hitting the guardrail. The results damaging to the car was a cracked left headlight shield. At this point, I sought advice with cost of $50 from Steve Barron, an attorney. An additional $125 was spent to have him write a letter to Subaru America. After Subaru America failed to respond to his letter, Mr. Barron indicated I had a case. Footnote, we did have a response from Subaru Northwest, and I do have a copy of that letter if you want to see that at another time. However, because of my current financial situation and because the attorney fees are not covered under the current law, I could not employ his services. On December 30th in 1986, I met with Brown to negotiate a trade for a new car. He asked if I was interested in a 1986 hatchback with 25,000 miles, a used car. I indicated I wanted other choices. Although Brown had no 4x4 wagons or sedans, he located a sedan in Albany. He was willing to sell the car at his cost. This transition cost Jim Brown approximately $700 because the current Lemon Law did not force Subaru America to replace my car. Brown did get Subaru Northwest to pick up the additional service package. However, it was different than the package I had originally purchased. The new package did not have unlimited miles. As you can see, I've had to invest considerable time, energy, and money to resolve my legal lemon. This process took 11 months and cost me additional $1,969.41 in a loan with Portland Teacher Credit Union. I might make another footnote. Yes, I do have a sedan 4x4, and when they brought it up on New Year's Eve, we weren't aware of that it has a defective glass, and so it's had to go back to I mean, one has to laugh. I mean, you know, if you don't have a sense of humor, you don't get through these things.
Right.
And so we replaced the defective glass, and now it still has the same defective glass in the new window, and I haven't decided what I'm going to do about that. But I would like to, since you have a good sense of humor, I'd like to share one personal story. I know it's getting late in the day, but in my testimony, I had indicated that Brent Gunderson asked me to return the dress, and I did return the dress. And the way I returned the dress, it was my red dress, and I went down to Angie Boutiques and I put in a big gray box. I also put a pair of old red shoes I had and a scarf in this box, and I put a big pink ribbon in it and took it to Bob Brown, and they had their parts man went and delivered it to Brent Gunderson at Super Northwest. Are there any questions or comments?
Any questions or comments? Well, thank you very much for sharing your very interesting and long story.
Thank you for the time.
And it's good you can still laugh. I don't know if I would be capable of doing that. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Does the committee have a copy of that?
Of her story?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. You should have a copy of it yourself. If not, we'll make sure you have one.
You might note, too, that the letter I had received from Jim Brown, and I think this is real valuable information, is that he indicated to me, and I'd like to quote, "We have learned a great deal throughout this difficult and lengthy endeavor. 99% of the population would not have endured as you did." And I just want to make that real clear. Because as you can see, I had to be real creative. They had to work with a procedure that I wasn't allowed to have a third-party arbitration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, for now, we'll close the hearing on this particular bill, 2599. And let me take just a moment to let's open the hearing on House Bill 2877. By the way, just to let NFIB and others know, we have another very important comeback bill, and I don't want to not allow appropriate time for that issue to be heard, so we won't hear that today. Who do we have? Okay, Roxanne Woolen, representing Dr. Jim Baker. Any relationship? Just teasing. Just a name I have on my mind.
Bought any dolls lately?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have a brief statement from Dr. James Baker regarding this House bill. I will read it for you now. Do you need any other clarification of who I am?
Just you have indicated who you are and who you're leading the presentation for. Just go ahead.
Significant food allergies affect 0.3% of children, and the incidence decreases with advancing age. For a population of 2 million, roughly 6,000 individuals are at risk of having an allergic reaction to food. This reaction can be severe and even fatal. Avoidance of the food antigen is the only acceptable approach to the problem. To avoid these antigens, one must know of their presence. It is impossible to know the content of recipe of a food from the menus in most restaurants. This means that most food allergic individuals cannot eat in restaurants safely. This testimony will document and elaborate on this problem and suggest that a remedy is needed. Food allergy can cause skin, gastrointestinal, and respiratory manifestations, hives, and swelling of the throat. are the most common. Diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting are less common. These manifestations can lead to death. Allergic reactions have been reported for nearly every food in existence, leading to the statement, any food can cause an allergic reaction. Coloring agents such as tartrazine yellow, found in many drinks, can cause anaphylaxis. Antitoxins such as metabisulfites and flavor enhancers such as MSG can cause serious reactions. The Chinese restaurant syndrome of burning sensation, facial and chest pain, and migraine headaches is caused by monosodium glutamate. These items are found in certain gravies, processed meats, some dry roasted nuts, and TV dinners, as well as various oriental meals. Cross-reacting foods can be a problem. For an example, an individual who is allergic to peanuts may react to other members of the legume family. Certain foods such as prunes, onions, and soybeans can cause irritation of the gut by means other than true allergic reactions. Various enzyme deficiencies may lead to serious reactions when the offending antigen is ingested. Alcohol can cause headaches and duplicate many of the allergic symptoms. Thus, the point is made that food antigens, additives, and preservatives can cause serious reactions. The presence of these food antigens, additives, and preservatives is not obvious without reading labels. Patients are given long lists of foods which might contain the offending antigen, but these lists are ultimately incomplete or out of date. Avoidance of the offending antigen is the only acceptable approach. Antihistamines and other anti-allergic medications do not prevent a reaction. Desensitization therapy, either oral or by injection, is not effective. Patients can carry adrenaline in a syringe to administer should they make a mistake and a reaction is starting. They should still go to an emergency room because the shot may not be completely control the reaction. Thus, what do affected individuals end up doing? They usually avoid restaurants or they take an educated guess. They rely on their own experiences, the advice of their allergist, the waiter, and the chef for details of the food they are about to ingest. This is somewhat like playing Russian roulette. Restaurant eating has become a way of life in our culture. Allergic individuals should have the menu, should have the means, and the right to enjoy this experience. I leave the specific suggestions regarding how to solve this problem to other testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
What degree does Dr. Jim Baker have?
He is a board-certified allergist and pediatrician.
MD?
Yes.
I guess I don't know what you're associating. You're just reading the testimony?
Yes, I am.
I just thought it was interesting to find that there was a Chinese restaurant syndrome. I just left up in the air there. It's all right.
That's quite all right, Andy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Cross. And I'm going to ask you to summarize as best as you can. In other words, keep it short, because I've got some folks that have made a special trip to participate in this process that will follow you that I want to make sure have adequate time.
Chairman Jolin, for the record, my name is Bill Cross, and I have with me today Larry Harvey, who is a legislative intern for us with the University of Portland. And he has done research on this, so I'm simply going to ask him to summarize that briefly. The statements he will be making are also on behalf of the Oregon Restaurant and Hospitality Association.
Thank you, Representative Jolin and committee members. My name is Larry Harvey. I am, as Mr. Cross indicated, an intern through the University of Portland working with the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association. I also have a cumulative number of years of experience of over 15 in the restaurant and hospitality industry. The testimony that you received is basically a brief summary of the statements that the Restaurant and Beverage Association would like to submit to you folks. As it indicates, we are simply concerned about the language proposed in House Bill 2877. And we would like to note that there is already a remedy for this particular problem, as is noted and the memorandum that is also part of the testimony that you received. This particular memorandum is from myself to Bill Cross to direct his attention to information that I discovered while working on this particular bill with Assistant Attorney General Laybourne. We simply would like to suggest that there are other means whereby this particular problem could be addressed, and I don't necessarily believe, nor does the Mr. Cross or the Oregon Restaurant and Hospitality Association believe that it would be necessary to initiate legislation simply to overcome any potential problems that may or may not exist. The last bit of information that you have there is Truth and Menu Guidelines, which are voluntary efforts that we offer to all of the members of the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association. It is an outline of what we strongly suggest to all of our members, which is well over 900 at this time. They voluntarily try to comply with all of these things, and to the best of our knowledge, we are not suffering from a tremendous number of problems regarding Truth and Menu or the items that are being used on in various preparation methods throughout this state with our association members. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions that you might have, but in the interest of brevity, I will conclude my statements at this time.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask several people to come down, simply because you're all sitting on the same side of the issue, if you don't mind. Diane Zellner, is that correct? Jean, or is it Jeannie?
Jean.
Jean Pulliam?
Yes.
Okay. Now this next one, it looks like Lois Fox, is that correct? Okay, and Sue Cameron. And but yes, and they have not formulated an opinion yet. So Sue, why don't you hold on? Okay. Whoever wants to go first. And again, I'd ask that you stay as to the point, brief as possible, but I want to make sure you all have an opportunity to have your say also.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Zellner, and I'm here in support of the Truth and Menu Bill. I'm one of the large number of people who do have very serious allergic reactions to specific foods, and I really have a need to know what I'm eating. Excuse me. As an example, approximately 2 years ago, I was in a well-known restaurant in Beaverton and ordered a dish that indicated it was served with butter sauce. Because I'm extremely allergic to artificial colors, I asked the waitress if it was really with butter or if it was margarine, and was assured that it was actually butter. So I ordered the meal. Within 2 hours, I was in the hospital, suffering an acute asthma attack, and remained in the hospital for several days. It was 2 weeks before I was able to return back to work. So as you can see, the bill is really important to me. It's especially meaningful to me and people like me who have severe allergies. There are many foods that contain artificial colors or other ingredients that cause severe reactions to people, but if they're improperly described on the menu, it's impossible to know what you're really eating. And in my case and that of many others, eating out is really currently a very risky and even life-threatening adventure. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Was it determined that it was margarine and not butter in this particular case?
Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson.
I guess since we're on this issue, it seems like a good time to ask questions about that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Was it indicated whether it was the waiter or waitress that didn't know, or was it intentionally done from the kitchen, or, I mean, I just see all kinds of possibilities here.
There were two things that I see wrong with what happened. Number one, it said butter sauce on the menu.
On the menu.
And so, but because I have an acute allergy to artificial color, I asked. So it was a double mistake. I'm sure it wasn't intentional in either case. I'm sure the people who have the restaurant butter sauce and margarine sauce. I mean, you know, who's going to put margarine sauce, you know, the name, and not realizing the implication to some people. And the waiter, I'm sure, you know, just didn't also realize, even though I said I'm very allergic, went back to the kitchen, what information he transmitted to the chef or whatever, I'm not sure, but when he came back, he says, yes, it's butter. And it was determined later that it, in fact, was margarine.
Please continue. Whoever would like to go next.
My name is Lois Fox, and I am here both on behalf of myself and my family and as a member of the American Association of University Women, who requested that this bill be brought to your attention. I am asking for your committee's support on House Bill 2877 and hope that today's testimony will help you in making that decision. The Oregon Division of AUW is interested in clarifying restaurant menus for a number of reasons. I have had personal experience with the problem of eating unknown foods with my two children, both of whom have allergies. My son is violently allergic to fish. His symptoms are immediate, not like 2 hours later, I mean they are within seconds, and include hives, facial swelling, vomiting, and difficulty in breathing. On occasion, we have had to administer CPR to get him going again. We have encountered problems with restaurant food, mainly due to everything being deep fried together. If he eats French fries fried in oil that fish has been in, he will react. He will react if utensils used to handle the fish are used for his food. He will react if the food he eats has touched fish. Needless to say, it is extremely difficult for us to eat out, particularly on the coast, where there's a lot of seafood served. While House Bill 2877 does not address this particular problem directly, it would certainly make a restaurant's method of food preparation available to inquiry upon request. We are not seeking to have each and every restaurant in the state list each and every ingredient used on its menu. House Bill 2877 would require restaurants to be accurate in its menu offerings. That is certainly no more than is required of packaged foods purchased in the grocery store. Not only is this information important to people with allergies, it is also important to people on low sodium or low cholesterol diets. It is important to people who want a low calorie meal. I don't think a list of ingredients available to patrons should create any hardship on a restaurant. When studies show that most of us eat at least one of our three daily meals away from home, it becomes apparent how important it is to expand truth in labeling to truth in menus. This issue has a certain parallel to the current requirement to provide various conveniences for handicapped people, i.e. ramps, parking, restrooms, etc. While there are very few people handicapped sufficiently to require these special arrangements, those that are find them indispensable. The same thing holds true for House Bill 2877. For those of us who need to know the content of food we are eating, accurate information is a necessity. And I thought of a couple of other things in listening to testimony. First of all, I wish the man from Jerry's Ice Cream was still here, because I think he would be more than happy to support what we're asking here, because obviously his ingredients are known to all that come into his restaurant. Second thing is, I find it a little incongruous to go into, for example, a Fred Meyer shopping center, and they have a deli in the center, and they have a place where you buy food already prepackaged. You can buy the same food in both places, and one you know what's in the food and the other you don't, simply because of the location. It's the same food. For instance, a donut. Fred Meyer has donuts in their bakery section. They have donuts in their deli section. In the bakery section, the ingredients are listed. In the deli section, they're not. And they're maybe 200 feet apart. I want to stress, because I have made trips to the emergency room with my children, that it's really important to a small section of the population, and where this may not be of overwhelming importance to a lot of people, to those of us it affects us dramatically.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Jolin, members of the Committee on Consumer and Business Affairs, and others, my name is Jean Pulliam. I live in Gresham. I am a citizen volunteer and a member of the American Association of University Women. This organization consists of over 3,000 college graduates throughout the state of Oregon and more than 175,000 college graduates in the United States. I am testifying for my organization and myself in support of House Bill 2877, which prohibits the use of false and misleading menus in restaurants. The American Association of University Women supports this bill because it recognizes the basic right to protect and inform consumers, and I concur. There are over 4,000 eating places in Oregon which receive approximately 16% of the consumer's food dollar every year. Those consumers have the right to receive unadulterated food for their dollar. An example of adulterated food is the chili which was served in a restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island, to a Brown University student. The student was allergic to peanuts. The chili had been thickened with peanut butter. The student died within an hour of ingesting the chili. The 1986 progress report of the Oregon Commission on Futures Research, a commission which was established by the 1983 Oregon legislature, states that, quote, we value honesty, integrity, and responsibility in the conduct of both the public affairs and private enterprise of Oregon, unquote. A copy of this statement has been attached to my testimony. If this statement is a perpetuation of Oregon values, then we must uphold the rights of a consumer. For example, a patron in a restaurant orders a crab Louis, he should be served real crab, not a substitute, or should be told, this is imitation crab. There is very little difference between buying food in a grocery store and buying